In April of 2014, really when I was just beginning to get my start here on Songtime Radio, I had the privilege of interviewing a young man, and I say young man because he was really only a few months older than me, born in April of 1983. I got a chance to interview Nabil Qureshi, who was raised as a devout Muslim, and yet in his adult years, after trying to defend his Islamic faith, he started to research Christianity and saw the truths of the gospel brought before his eyes and converted to Christianity. He was partnered with Ravi Zacharias and his international ministry as an apologist and a gifted mind and a scholar and somebody who really understood and connected with the community in which he came out of, the Muslim community, and had the opportunity to write this amazing book called Seeking Allah, Finding Jesus. Well, it's really with sadness that I have to say that Nabil passed away just recently here, September 16th, 2017, after fighting a long battle with cancer. So I wanted to take this moment to look back on this early interview in my own radio ministry and to share with you a little bit of this uncut, untouched interview with Nabil. And as he shares his heart and his ministry, I hope that his ministry and his legacy live on as an impact to reach the Muslim community with the gospel of Jesus Christ. So in memory and in honor of Nabil and his faithfulness to the Lord's work, I want to share with you this uncut interview I had the opportunity to talk with Nabil Qureshi about his book, Seeking Allah, Finding Jesus. I've got your book here, Seeking Allah, Finding Jesus, and excited to be doing the interview with you and finding out a little bit about you and your book here. So,
sounds good. We're talking about a 30-minute interview, correct?
Yes. Yep.
Okay, great.
And basically what we'll do is break it down into 6 to 7 minute segments. So, in post-edit and spread it out on multiple days. So, you just kind of keep that in mind as we go through the interview. Why don't we get started by having you tell us a little bit about yourself? Obviously, this book is about yourself, but give us your backstory. Tell us a little bit about Nabil. Oh, by the way, before I get started, make sure I'm saying your name correctly.
Yes, Nabil Qureshi.
Good, good. All right. Tell us a little bit about your background and about where you came from.
Yeah, I was born in the United States. My parents are from Pakistan, and I was raised as a devout Muslim in the United States. And so what that looked like for us as a family, it was my sister and I, plus my parents, was we were taught to follow Islam from a very young age. My mother was actually the daughter of a Muslim missionary. She was born in Indonesia, even though her father was from Pakistan. She was a missionary kid, and so when she moved to the United States and had me and my sister, she taught us the ways of Islam. She taught us to read pray the Salat 5 times a day, to recite the Quran daily. By the age of 5, I had the last 7 chapters of the Quran memorized. So it was a very devout practice of Islam. And part of being Muslim in the West is being equipped to defend oneself against Christianity. And so not only was I taught reasons to believe Islam and how to live the Islamic lifestyle as a child, but I was also taught how to respond to the Christian theology by challenging the deity of Christ, for example, or the reliability of the Bible, or that the Trinity is a monotheism. I used to tell people it's polytheism. So that was what my background in childhood was like.
And give us a little bit of an insight. You talked about being a Western Muslim. Is that distinctly different than if you were in Pakistan or somewhere else in the Middle East?
I would say I was raised in the West, and so I was given a perspective of the world that is affected by Western modes of thinking. But that said, I was also taught the traditional teachings of Islam growing up. So I wasn't really exposed to Western thought until I got to school. So for me, it's a kind of a mix. It is different, though, East versus West. In the East, you have a lot of people who operate in kind of an honor-shame paradigm, and they see the world and their position in it and their duties as a result of power structures, authority, of their own place. They're not really thinking in terms of innocence and guilt. That's kind of a Western paradigm. I'm going to make decisions based on what makes me feel innocent, or, you know, I'm afraid to feel guilty about this one, so I'm not going to make this decision here. No, in the East, people make it based on social paradigms of honor and shame. Mm-hmm. And so, yes, you do have people thinking quite differently from East and West. And since Islam is such an authority-driven religion, Muhammad taught because of authority. We learn the traditions about Islam through lines of authority. Since it's so much authority-driven, it often looks different in the West from people who see it totally from an innocence guilt paradigm.
Mm. Now, give us a little bit of a perspective, because I think what your book is doing here, Seeking Allah, Finding Jesus, A Devout Muslim Encounters Christianity, what you're doing here is not just telling your story of conversion, which we'll get to in a second, but you're also kind of opening our Western eyes to Islam and some things that we probably have a lot of misconceptions about. Is there a diversity amongst devout Muslims? You mentioned you're a devout Muslim. Is there a large diversity as to kind of the working out of Islam, even amongst the devout?
Oh, absolutely. Just like you have a diversity of Christian practices, from Orthodox to Catholic to Protestant, and then all the different denominations within, you have very different practices of Islam, different sects. You've got, of course, the two major branches, Shia and Sunni. And then within those, you have many smaller denominations. So, yes, Islam is very diverse. And then when he's talking about specific Muslims, then it becomes even more diverse, because sometimes a Muslim can be devout, other times it can be nominal, secularized, also from different regions of the world. You have a lot of cultural practices that get intertwined with Islam. For example, some people associate genital mutilation with Islam. I'm not sure you can draw a strong case for that, but there are regional areas where Muslims do practice that because of their culture, not because of Islam per se. Mm. So sometimes you have regional practices that get intermingled there. All this combines into very, very different forms of Islam, and quite frankly, you'll have as many different versions of Islam as you do Muslims at the end of the day. So a very, very good point. That's one thing I'm trying to show from my book, is the diversity within Islam. But also I want to show people how it plays out when Westerners think about Muslims. What are they thinking? How accurate is that? Peace and violence, jihad and politics, how does that play into the conversations we have and the people we run into on the street? That's all a part of what I'm trying to show in my book.
Yeah, and that's certainly something we want to address, but this book is also your testimony. Being a devout Muslim, you came to a place in your life where you examined the scriptures and learned about Jesus, and that changed you, correct? So tell us a little bit about your conversion.
Well, thanks. Yes, that is correct. I hope through the vehicle of my testimony to accomplish a few things, and one of those is to share my story, because for me, I was raised so devout in Islam that the practice of Islam was for me rooted in the truth of Islam, and Islam is like Christianity in that sense. They both claim to be historical faiths. They both claim to be rooted in real events. You juxtapose that with Hinduism and Buddhism, for example, which more or less are removed from history. It doesn't really matter what happened historically. These are a set of beliefs you can follow. Islam and Christianity, not like that. So in Islam, then, the reason why I believed Islam was true is because I believed a man named Muhammad was a prophet of God, and that he revealed... he was revealed the Quran, which is the book of God. And so my story then goes through the devout practice of a Muslim, what that looks like. It's all-encompassing. It's not just a set of beliefs that Muslims have. It's a whole way of life that they live. And so I share that in my book, and what that looks like, and then I also share how Christianity has claims that run directly contrary to Islam. Islam says, for example, that Jesus did not die on the cross, that he is not God, and Christianity claims that those two must be true, and the resurrection must be true in order for Christianity to be true. And so I used to challenge Christians in their faith on these matters, providing arguments from the Bible, usually, that Jesus did not claim to be God, that he did not die on the cross, and he did not rise from the dead. It wasn't until I ran into a Christian who was able to start defending his faith that I started realizing, wait a minute, maybe Christianity has good reasons for it. And so I started looking into that evidence. And after a few years of weighing the evidence for Christianity against the evidence for Islam, after having studied the historical method, after having studied how to assess our records of history, I realized that the case for Christianity was far stronger than the case for Islam. And at that point, my studies stopped, and I started taking a personal direction in seeking God's guidance. And through dreams and visions, the Lord led me to accept Christ.
So explain to me what you just were saying there, that the validity for Christianity was more reliable than the validity for the historical perspective on Islam. How did you kind of research that? I mean, what books do you go to authenticate the validity of the history that we have in our faith?
Great question. People generally assume that you can't use the Bible. I think that's a bit short-sighted. The Bible is not one book, first off. It's 66 books, and 27 of them are in the New Testament. Four of them are about Jesus, and they take a historical approach, not a theological approach. And so what we are supposed to do as historians, and historians do this with every book from history, they weigh out the biases and they attempt to sift past those in order to get to the accurate history recorded in the books. So even if you're not a Christian, you should be able to come to the Gospels and say, how reliable are these, historically speaking? Let me subject them to the tests of the historical method. And what you find out is that the Gospels are very early compared to other books that purport to record history. For example, Alexander the Great, the first major biography we have on him, comes 400 years after he dies. Whereas the Gospels, Mark's Gospel, comes no later than four decades after Jesus dies. And then, of course, we have stuff from Paul's writing, from 1 Corinthians, for example, that comes within two decades of Jesus' death. I mean, this is remarkably early stuff. So you don't have to accept it as the Word of God to use it historically. But thankfully, there are also extra-biblical resources. Of course, Christian extra-biblical resources from ancient history, but also non-Christian. So when it comes to an issue like the death of Jesus on the cross, for example, you have five non-Christian ancient writers who record the death of Jesus on the cross. And they're Jewish. For example, the Talmud and Josephus record it. And there are also Greeks and Romans, like Tacitus and Lucian of Samosata. So you've got extra-biblical sources from Gentiles, from Jews, from the early first centuries after Jesus. All this history can help us build a case for Christianity. Whereas when you take a look at Islam, it's simply not there. The earliest sources we have on Islam come from approximately two centuries after Muhammad's death. And now you're looking at things that say a lot that is contrary to what Muslims are teaching. So even those earliest records often contradict popular Muslim thought, and that's where the problems start arising.
Here's an interesting question. Is the Quran kind of given the same sense of scrutiny and scholarship as the Bible is, even amongst Christians who are studying manuscripts and Textus Receptus and the Dead Sea Scrolls and all these things? Is the Quran given that same sort of scrutiny, or is it simply accepted and that scrutiny is kind of looked down on?
The critical study of the Quran is approximately two centuries behind the critical study of the Bible. So you really don't have, for example, a critical textual apparatus. Like for the New Testament, if you want to have a critical apparatus, you can go to NA28 or UBS or the new SBL editions. You can go to critical New Testament texts. The Quran, nothing like that has been developed. Some work had started right before World War II, and then a lot of that work was lost during the bombings over Germany. There was a man named Arthur Jeffrey in the early part of the 20th century. He was working on it, but it's just now beginning to pick up. And part of the reason why is because these manuscripts are in places that are closed off to Westerners, and Muslim scholars aren't willing to do the same kind of critical study that Western scholars are supposed to do. So it requires a kind of person who's both critically minded, but also very congenial, in order to get into these places. But thankfully, I think people are being raised up now who fulfill that and who are beginning to do this kind of study. I would highly suggest the work of Keith Small, who just published a dissertation on the textual variants in Quran manuscripts. There's also a PhD dissertation that's just being defended now out of Rice University called Intentional Variants in Quran Manuscripts. I'm sorry, Intentional Changes in Quran Manuscripts by Daniel Brubaker. So it's taking off now, but it's 200 years behind biblical studies.
All right. Well, give us a little bit of an insight coming from a devout Muslim background into looking back at it now as a Christian, as an apologist, as a public speaker. When you look back at the Quran, do you kind of see some of those things that you're talking about, these inconsistencies, the historical narratives that don't exist anywhere else in the world, do you see those kind of standing out, or are they kind of vaguely represented to a way in such that some Muslims would kind of still accept it because of its vagueness?
Well, there are a few things I would like to say about this. The first thing I'd like to say is that the Quran is not a historical book. People, as far as recording history, the Quran doesn't attempt to do that. It is not, for example, talking about Muhammad's life. Muhammad is only mentioned by name four times in the book. The word Mecca, which is supposedly where the Quran, parts of the Quran were revealed, only mentioned by name once. It's attempting to be a book of laws and rules and reminders. So, number one, we can't approach it the same way. And number two, it's a totally different kind of book. People just assume the Bible and the Quran are similar. No, the Bible is an anthology of various works with a lot of different genres. For example, Song of Solomon is very different from Proverbs, is very different from Acts, which is very different from Romans, etc. The Quran is one book which I think was intended to be an oral book. It was never intended to be written. And so it operates in an oral modality. And because of that, you have many portions of the Quran that just simply, if you start reading it from beginning to end, don't flow. It's kind of patchwork because it's used in a liturgical sense. It's used for recitation during the daily prayers. And so its use, its intention is very different from the Bible's. And we can't extract the same kind of things from it. And quite frankly, that's why Muslims around the world don't use it the way Christians use the Bible. Mm. Generally speaking, when Muslims are going to refer to Islamic teaching, they're going to turn to a teacher who is going to have interpreted portions of the Quran combined with the Hadith. They're definitely not going to go straight to the Quran and use only the Quran. That doesn't happen, generally speaking, in the Islamic world. So a very different type of book, both in its composition and its purposes and its use.
So that seems like that would lend to a very diverse groupings of Muslims, because you would have to have an exterior authority on the Quran in order to explain what it means to that culture.
Exactly, exactly. And so that's why you have so many different books of hadith. The hadith are the traditions of Muhammad that scholars and clerics use to elucidate teachings on the Quran. And that's why you can have some Muslims who end up saying Islam is a religion of peace, because you've got scholars who focused on the peaceful parts of the Quran and extrapolated the peaceful hadith and say, look, this is what Islam teaches, whereas you have people like Salafis and Wahhabis who are going to take the violent portions of the Quran and combine them with the violent hadith to say this is what Islam teaches. Mm. You're absolutely right.
So this is kind of a new kind of revelation even for me. I think as Americans and Western thinkers, we kind of clump everyone together, which really is inconsistent, because we can look in our own diversity of churches and find that there isn't a single, cohesive thought amongst Americans in our culture today. But we think of this clumping of Muslims together in the Middle East and around the world as if they all hold to the same set of laws. Maybe that's because they all have a similar kind of attire, and I mean there is a variance in that, but it's a very devout external faith.
Yes, I think that we do unfortunately categorize a lot of people together. Now, part of that's our own fault, and quite frankly, it's just human nature to categorize the other somehow. you have to kind of do that in order to function and survive. But it's to be an enlightened follower of Christ, especially, you're supposed to love individuals and get to know them as individuals. So it is that on the one hand, but also Muslims do tend to align more tightly with their identity than Christians do. And I'm talking about, you know, an average self-identifying Christian. Whether or not they follow Jesus is not what I'm referring to, but someone who's willing to identify themselves as a Christian often doesn't really care about their heritage. But when it comes to Muslims, anyone who's willing to self-identify as a Muslim usually sees that as their identity, and therefore they will align with other Muslims even if they disagree with them, because they represent basically the same family. And so we will often interpret that in the West as all Muslims are thinking the same, they're all acting the same. No, they're just not willing to condemn one another quite often. And so there's a lot of factors that are going on here, but the key one that I do want to emphasize is that not all Muslims think alike, far from it. They're all very different from each other. And the average Muslim simply is like the average Westerner. They just want to love their family, provide for them, and succeed in life.
So give us a perspective on some of the misconceptions that we have on Muslims. Obviously, the ones that we hear about the most kind of skew the data. We hear about the terrorist and the extremist, but talk to us a little bit about some of our misconceptions that would help us in thinking and praying and even witnessing to Muslims.
Well, the first thing is, of course, 9/11 hit so close to home. And immediately we had two very stark reactions. You had those who wanted to blame all of this on Islam, and then you had the others that wanted to defend Islam and say Islam's a religion of peace. Even George Bush came out on record saying Islam is a religion of peace. Of course, Barack Obama has come out and said something similar, that it has a proud tradition of tolerance. So what is the truth? And since you have these two conflicting stories, people are just really confused. What is true about Islam? And so they don't know how to see their Muslim neighbor. There's a lot of confusion, and there's a lot of distrust. And, of course, there's a lot of talk over the past few years about Sharia in the United States. And so you have people wondering, is this mosque that's being built next door, is that a mosque that's going to harbor terrorists, or are they going to try to impose Sharia law on us? A lot of this kind of thinking. My main reaction to this as a Christian is that we as Christians have not been called to act out of self-preservation. Exactly the opposite. As a Christian, I'm called to pour myself out, be willing to even die for the sake of those who might disagree with me, because that's exactly what Jesus did, according to my theology. And so if we're supposed to follow him, we're not supposed to act out of self-preserving interests. So my encouragement to Christians around the United States and around the world is to love their Muslim neighbors, get to understand them individually, drop these fears, drop these worries, because the average Muslim doesn't have a nefarious agenda. They're just here, like I said, they just want to love their families, they want to succeed. That's what the average Muslim's like. And so just get to know them individually as a person, put aside the fear, and move forward in building relationships so that you can share Christ with them.
Well, here, let me give you a few things that maybe you can respond to as to some things that I hear quite a bit from my peers as to their fears and their maybe misconceptions about Islam, and you can address them. I really did like what you said about living worthy of the gospel, and we're not supposed to be self-preserving. That seems to be one of the biggest areas of conflict, is it's my worldview versus their worldview. It's our values versus their values. What you mentioned that they care for their families, they want to raise their families. What is generally the values of your average Muslim?
Your average Muslim is a lot more family-oriented. And you can take that back to a tribal instinct if you want to. I don't think that's far from the truth. But very, very family-oriented, and in the same traditional tribal sense, very hospitality-oriented. When someone comes to visit them, they're going to go out of their way to make sure that they are cared for, that they're provided for, that in the home they have places of honor and the best food. So traditionally, and like I said, you can't lump all Muslims together, but traditionally, people from Islamic culture is very hospitable, very family-oriented, very passionate about their beliefs and opinions. And that's another thing that comes from most of the rest of the world. People don't mind talking about religion and politics. It's what's on their heart, so that's what they want to talk about. Of course, devout Muslims are going to be focused on the oneness of God. This is kind of the central doctrine of Islam. In Christianity, if you can think of one unifying ethic that binds all of Christianity's teachings, I would say it's love. And Jesus said something very similar in Matthew 22. So love binds everything in Christianity, whereas in Islam, the thing that kind of binds all Islamic teachings is the oneness of God. Tawheed is what it's called. And so that's why the idea of Jesus being God and the Trinity is so blasphemous to Muslims. It goes against what they've been taught as the core of their faith. So if those are kind of the values of Muslims. I would also say an adherence to tradition and authority is generally speaking a part of Islamic values. But I do also want to clarify that in the West, people who are born and raised in the West often get quite secularized. And so secular Western Muslims look just like secular Western non-Muslims. They look basically the same. So we shouldn't get those categories confused.
Mm-hmm. Now, I think one of the areas that we hear a lot, and you mentioned it already, is that Christians call or Americans consider Islam a religion of war and a religion built and based and kind of demonstrating violence. And yet we hear from Bush and Obama that it is a religion of peace and tolerance. Is that something that is external, as you mentioned before, you're talking about the Quran is not really very specific. Can it be drawn from the Quran, the violent behavior, or is that something that is externally implied from the Quran?
It certainly can be drawn from the Quran. Chapter 9 of the Quran is the most violent chapter. But according to Islamic theologians, it was also the final chapter, or the final major chapter anyway, that Muhammad left his people with. So Islam, when you start looking at the history of the Quran, according to Islamic theologians now, the basic trajectory of peace and violence is that Islam started out peaceful when Muhammad started preaching Islam, and then by the time Muhammad died, you have chapter 9, which says things like, slay the infidels wherever you find them. It says, fight the Jews and Christians. So the trajectory of theology within the Quran goes from peaceful to violent. And then you have the hadith, the traditions in Islam, which say some rather violent things too. For example, Muhammad says, I will expel the Jews and Christians from Arabia and not leave any but Muslim alive. And unless, this one's from Sahih Muslim, it says, unless you recite the Shahada, means unless you become Muslim, your life and your property will not be safe from me. So these kinds of teachings. And then the early history of Islam, of course, was rife with wars. Within 150 years after Muhammad's death, Muslims had conquered a third of the known world. Mm-hmm. So the argument is, can we ascribe this to Islam, or do we ascribe this to early Muslims, or to bad history? And at the end of the day, I think it's pretty clear. The earliest records, if they are to be trusted, shows that Islam was conceived in violence by the time Muhammad died, but I do not claim that those records are trustworthy.
Okay. So I think one of the areas that people, maybe Western thinkers, have a hard time understanding this because of that chapter 9 that talks about violence and killing infidels, it's hard for Americans, I think of somebody who will follow every other aspect of the law, wearing the burqa and all those things, and not think of them as being someone who would follow it to the very extent of the law, which is to kill infidels. Is that a misconception, or why don't all Muslims hold to it as tightly as we might think they should?
It goes back to the beginning of what we discussed. The Quran isn't referred to as the Bible is. You don't have Muslims going straight to the Quran and saying, here you go, it's what it says, it's what I'm going to do. No, they go to their teachers, and their teachers will interpret it for them. And quite often, teachers, like, for example, in the West, will say, oh, Surah 9, verse 5, Surah 9, verse 29, yes, those are violent, but those had a specific context for a specific time. They no longer apply. Kind of as we would say for those commands found in the Old Testament laws. So they will give it that kind of interpretation. Whereas teachers in other parts of the world will say, no, that still applies. The peaceful stuff has been canceled. So that's why you actually have an honest, genuine difference in the way Islam is practiced, even though those verses are found in the Quran. Now, which of those two are practicing better exegesis? That's a different question. But as far as the practical life of the Muslims in the U.S., generally speaking, they are genuinely peaceful.
So talk to us a little bit about Sharia law. I don't think many Christians know it, and if they do know anything about it, it's probably been skewed by a non-Muslim background person. So give us a little perspective. This is probably the misconception, or maybe it's a reality that I've heard the most, is that it is a law that can be enforced upon other people, even if they're not converting to Islam, that the law is key, the law is more important than conversion.
This is a very vast subject. And by the way, I have 9 hours of lectures on these matters online on YouTube. Just type it in. I taught these courses at Biola University. So if someone wants to learn about Sharia, just type in Nabil Qureshi, Biola Sharia, and you'll have an hour-long lecture. But just to be brief, Sharia is what Muslims say God has intended for the world, the law that God has intended for the world. Muslims will interpret that differently because there's no one book of Sharia. They have to ascertain what Sharia is through jurisprudence, using the Quran, using the Hadith. So it looks different for all different kinds of Muslims. But in answer to your specific question, yes, Muslims do believe that even non-Muslims can be compelled to follow Sharia. But generally speaking, that needs to happen in an Islamic nation. They wouldn't believe you could do that in the West.
So in this context, we have to understand why most Western Muslims have such strict homes, but they're not as involved in politics. Is that what you're sort of saying?
I would say that begins to approximate their reasoning, yes.
Okay. Well, here's another question that I hear a lot amongst Christians that are kind of building this this rhetoric against Islam, is the idea of the mosque at Ground Zero, the idea of the Ottoman Empire, and that Israel can't exist and has to be wiped off the face of the earth. There's this mindset that once ground has been gained for Allah, they can't return it back to infidels, and that really drives them to build mosque and to claim land and to claim a dominion over an area. Give us some perspective as to kind of the breadth of that. Is that really just the mindset of the extremist, or is that kind of a broader perspective on Islam?
I would say if we're going to approach that rigidly, you can't return land to those from whom it has been taken. I would say that would fall under the purview of an extremist mindset. Now, if you take it a little bit more softly and say we shouldn't, you know, for Islam, for the victory, ultimate victory of Islam, we shouldn't do that. I would say that would then broaden the population to which it applies. But all the same, like I said before, the average Muslim is not thinking in these terms. You know, as far as when they're building a mosque, they're generally thinking, hey, we need a place to get together and pray on Fridays. Or, you know, 5 days a week, but especially on Fridays. They're thinking about fellowship. They're thinking about community. If there are those who are thinking from more or less political perspectives, it's a very small number.
And I was in Israel about a few months ago, back in October, and got to see a unique perspective, something honestly I wasn't expecting to see, where Islam and Druze, as well as the Jewish and Christians, are all kind of living together. You kind of think of Israel as a Jewish state, and they only have Jewish officials, but there's Muslim officials, there's Druze officials. Talk to us a little bit about the debate, the struggle that's going on right there in the Middle East, and kind of from your perspective, what the challenges are for Israel and the countries that have denied their sovereignty.
As far as Israel and Palestine is concerned, I'm going to disclaim up front by saying I'm not an expert in these matters. Political Islam is not my focus. It's the religion of Islam.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really what this is. It's become a political issue. As far as land and these wars and the way this is all running now, it's more or less political. And it's, I think, my assessment is that under the guise of religion, people are clamoring for power.
Mm-hmm.
That's how I see it. And yes, Jerusalem was important to the early Muslims. Not nearly as important as people claim it is, but it was. So you do have vested interests from multiple groups in this area. But at the end of the day, I think it's a matter of using religion to justify a desire for power and land.
Mm. All right, well, let's get back to you and what you accomplish. This book is really your story, and we talked a lot about what your ministry really is trying to accomplish, giving clarity to what is actually taking place in the Muslim communities and how we as Christians should think and pray for and minister to these people. What is your ministry? You work with Ravi Zacharias, which is a great ministry we have a lot of respect for here at Songtime. Talk to us about what you're doing now and what your ministry entails.
I have the privilege of being able to travel with Ravi Zacharias and to speak alongside him, as well as going to universities on my own. Generally speaking, I do aim to speak to university students, but I'll also speak at conferences and churches and the like. And my hope is to explain to people what the gospel means for them and why it is true. So I want, of course, evangelism and sharing the gospel, but not just sharing it as a message amongst many or as something that they should receive because they want to go to heaven. I think that's a very selfish reason to accept the gospel, but to explain how the gospel makes the pieces of the world fit together and how it gives us our position in life, the way we were intended to live, the way we live best, is when we understand the teachings of the gospel. And so I explain that, I unpack that, but I also provide reasons to believe it as best I can anyway, from science, from history, from philosophy, from anthropology and the like.
Mm-hmm. And now your ministry can be found through Ravi's website, and how can people access and find out more information about you and your book here, Seeking Allah and Finding Jesus?
Yes, thank you for asking. If you go to SeekingAllahFindingJesus.com, that will take you to an information page on the RZIM website about my book. And from there, you can go straight to my bio, my Twitter page, etc. You can also go to NabilQureshi.com, and that will take you straight to my bio as well. So SeekingAllahFindingJesus.com and NabilQureshi.com. And the rest of the team at RZIM can be found at RZIM.org.
Great, great. Well, thank you, Nabil, so much for being with us today and giving us a perspective that honestly I did not have before, and I felt like I was a pretty good student and trying to find out all this information, but your unique perspective, your ability to articulate it and explain it in such clear and concise terms and honest, intellectually honest terms was very helpful for me, and I hope helpful to our audience as well.
Well, thanks for the feedback, brother. I pray that this causes people to love their Muslim neighbors as themselves and to seek God with everything they have.
All right. Nabil, thank you again. It really is a privilege, and we have a lot of respect for the ministry that you're doing, as well as Ravi. He's a good friend of the ministry here, and we want to thank you for this book. It's a great resource, and we hope that our listeners will take advantage of it.
Thank you for having me on, brother. I appreciate it.
God bless. Bye-bye.
You too. Bye-bye.
We hope you enjoyed this interview made possible by our ministry at Songtime Radio. You can find out more information about our ministry by visiting our website at songtime.com, where you can find this and other interviews on our podcast series, as well as our weekday broadcast, which includes teaching, interviews, and music. We also want to encourage you to sign up for our free monthly newsletter. It's got encouraging articles, and there is no obligation. To find out more information about our ministry, again, visit our website at songtime.com. This ministry is made possible by people just like yourself. We are 100% supported by our listeners. So if you have been blessed today, why not join with the many voices together for that one message, the gospel of Jesus Christ, with your donation to the Songtime Ministry. To make a donation, you can do so online at our website at songtime.com, as well as by mail. Write to us at Songtime Radio, P.O. Box 100, Barnstable, Massachusetts, 02630, or give us a call. Make a donation over the phone. It's 508-362-7070. On behalf of our entire Songtime staff and our own Dr. John DeBrine, the founder here at Songtime, who encourages you to grow in grace and not groan in disgrace, from Cape Cod, I'm Adam Miller. God bless.